Overlooking Phoenix, from high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios, Badge Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, the show where two retired cops talk to the community. I'm retired Crime Stopper Sergeant Darren Birch.
I'm retired Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterly.
And we have a great show for you because we have a great guest, a career cop in Portland. We're going to learn about Portland, the tale of two cities, before and after defunding of the police. Then we're going to go into Cop Talk, where we will again talk about what Portland looks like now because of the rise and... Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were going to say something, my friend.
No. When it comes to Portland, I'm kind of speechless right now. So I'll fix that in the next 10 minutes. Don't worry.
And then our last segment, we'll get into our heroic headlines, our stupid suspect stories, and Jason's always inspirational closing message. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
You know, I just love career cops because they have such heart, such passion. And someone reached out to me probably about 3 weeks ago about one of our shows that we did about Seattle and Portland, and just kind of weighed in with some new information. And it was clear their heart and soul is breaking with what's going on. Yeah. I want to introduce Charlie Fender. He is he was retired as a lieutenant out of Portland. He had an incredible career, a stellar career, 29 plus years. He, like I said, retired as a lieutenant, but he was a patrol shift commander. He was in charge of the train division, professional standards bureau. This guy was a SWAT team commander. I mean, we're talking about truly a stellar career, medals, and you name it, this guy achieved it, awarded the Police Achievement Medal. Charlie, first and foremost, thank you for your career, what you did in Portland, and thank you for being on our show.
Thank you for having me. You're getting me choked up already.
We've had conversations, and Jason is in the same boat. Our heart just bleeds for law enforcement today. It just does. But before we get into that, because we kind of want to save that for kind of the Cop Talk segment,
Sure. Tell
me about your career, how it started. Walk me through life as a Portland cop.
Oh, that's tough. So I joined the Portland Police Bureau in August of 1990, about 5 weeks after I turned 21. So I was young. After going through training and all that kind of young cop stuff, I was assigned to precinct in the inner north, northeast Portland, which at the time in the early 90s was just about the time when gangs from Southern California were coming up here. We had our first gang homicide in like 88, 89, somewhere. And I loved working up in that area. 13 years up there, just going call to call, from shooting to fight to stabbing and, you know, all that stuff that you love as being a new cop. And about year 13, I took a sergeant's test, got promoted, was assigned as a patrol sergeant in downtown Portland. After doing that for a couple of years, I took on the job downtown as what they call a special event sergeant. So anytime there was a permitted event, unpermitted protest, I was kind of the liaison between the police bureau and those groups. Managed, hundreds of events that, went up to 10,000-15,000 people. I enjoyed that. From there, I went to the gang enforcement team, was a sergeant there for 5 years. So specifically, investigating, surveilling, serving search warrants on gang members that in most of our cases were shootings. From there, I went to the training division. No, I went to professional standards. Sorry, I've got to back this up in my head. As an acting lieutenant, got promoted to lieutenant, was doing kind of risk management, case management, some internal affairs stuff. And then from there, I went to the training division. I'd always had a passion for training. I was a driving instructor for 26 years of my career and a firearms instructor for 25, somewhere in there.
Wow.
Yeah, it was good stuff.
Two of the more important things in law enforcement that people don't realize, how to freaking drive and how to shoot, is always always two important things that people take for granted.
Well, and I enjoyed being part of developing skills for officers that kept them safe. You know, that's what we all wanted.
Keyword. It's what we all want. Civilians and law enforcement. We just want to be safe and get home at the end of the day. That's the mantra for life.
Absolutely. You know, when I was part of the driving program, we started to introduce, you know, scenario-based training. I mean, it's one thing to put somebody in a skid car or, you know, on a cone course, but, you know, and teach them how to make, how to be a good driver. But it's another thing when you're in a mock pursuit and the adrenaline's going. And so we really kind of in the, I guess this would have been the late 90s, developed a scenario-based training program that was kind of, I don't want to say it was the first in the nation, but it was kind of cutting edge in police driving programs. So I was really proud to be part of that. From there, I went back to the precincts as a shift commander, and it was about that time that I took on the role of the assistant SWAT team commander and just loved doing that stuff. And then spent the last, 3 to 5 years of my career back on the street in uniform and retired November of last year.
There's a question that Jason always asks people about, and he's looking at me saying,
No,
I want you.
Serve it up.
It's yours, my friend, please.
There is a question that I always ask, especially when I sit here and listen to the amazing career you had. But selfishly, and I think our audience will enjoy hearing it, tell me why you originally put your name on the application.
Well, I when I was in college, I was taking, you know, some criminal justice programs, and before I turned 21, I was doing practicum work at the downtown central precinct and was, you know, being around cops, seeing how they acted, seeing what they did, went on some ride-alongs, and just I was able to see what kind of a positive impact law enforcement had on the community. And, you know, you guys know this, you know, people don't call 911 and ask the cops to come over when, you know, Johnny's having a birthday party. They call 911 when bad things are happening to Johnny or to their family. And I wanted to be part of that solution.
That is perfect.
When you look back at your career and, you know, as detectives, we always say there's that one case. But as just a career cop, there's that one thing that just really hit home in terms of why you did what you did and how rewarding it is. Is there that one story that hits home that you felt, you know, this is why I became a cop?
Oh my gosh. I wish I would have wrote some of this stuff down. I know, you know, most cops talk about when they retire, I should have kept notes, wrote a journal. I could have wrote a book. You know, exactly. I've probably forgot more. Well, not probably. I definitely have forgot more than I remembered. I remember, when I was an officer, my partner and I, Kevin, were aware of a reoccurring family beef that was happening in our district. And one night we got a call of a shooting on the street, and two people were shot and killed in their car. And we're managing the crime scene and taping it off and calling detectives. And I look up, well, we both looked up and saw the ex-wife of the victim and his current girlfriend standing there. I'm thinking, why the hell would she be here? Well, we grabbed her up, called detectives. She confessed to it. And so, you know, solving a double homicide. I mean, most street cops, you know, don't do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of like what you dream of, you know, when you raise your hand exactly. And want to be a cop. You know, it's that adrenaline rush of catching bad guys or bad girls.
Yeah, I mean, it was a terrible scene. Unfortunately, two people lost their lives. But knowing that our knowledge of this particular family and the history there was a big part of, you know, solving the double homicide. And, you know, there's always the you know, most cops retire and they will always remember all the horrific scenes and the bad things that you've seen. And you just try to find a place to put those and just lock them away.
You know, when I look back at my career, I can tell you what I think was most rewarding, what I think was most effective. And I hate to be selfish on this, but what was the most fun for you? What was the most fun that you had on the job?
Just being around the most amazing people in the world, the cops.
Yeah, I've always talked about... I
love how emotional you get.
Yes.
The camaraderie.
Yeah.
It's not just a word.
No.
It means
it's a brotherhood. Family.
Much.
Well, I was just going to say, it's, you know, it's a good time to be a retired Portland cop, but I still miss
no, that's for
day.
Sure.
I miss the people. I miss the people more than anything.
Yeah, I always talk about, I don't miss the circus, but I miss the clowns.
Yeah.
Yep, exactly. You had a front row seat to the circus of life.
Yeah, I don't think our spouses ever understood why we were so excited to go to work. And more of it was your squad. Your peers,
yeah.
Your
first
friends.
Squad, right? That first
and,
squad.
You know, what call am I going to answer for that the first person's going to say, you know, I got your back. And it's just, I love to hear your emotions because there is, I was in certain situations that I couldn't get to my radio, couldn't let the dispatcher know, or, you know, I had to put out a, hey, and it's so funny in police jargon, if you just simply say, I need another unit, which is, it, on its face, means, hey, can you just slow roll me a car? You say that, and the cavalry shows up, and there's nothing in this world like hearing the sound of sirens coming when you need them most. Oh, it's just,
man. I can remember a couple times being in fights where I had to call what we call the code zero, which is, I'm about to get my ass kicked. Can you send me the world?
That's our code. That's our code seven.
Yep, within seconds. And at the time, back in the late 90s, you know, we had the 96 the Chevy LT1350s that were just a badass fast car. To hear, you heard them before the sirens, you know, getting close. It's like, all right, the cavalry's here. I just got to hang on just a little bit longer.
Isn't that the best feeling in the world?
Oh, it is.
And when they get there, you can be like, you know what, I'm going to go sit on the curb, just kind of take a break, relax, let you guys handle this. It's the best.
Can you put the cuffs on for me?
Exactly. I'm a little tired. I'm going to go take a break.
Yep, no, it's a great feeling. Nothing better in the world.
Speaking of nothing better in the world, great feeling, what was the most rewarding assignment you ever worked in? Because, again, you've worked a lot of assignments. You were in SWAT. You were in training. You're all over the place, including Professional Standards Bureau.
Yeah. You know, being on the gang enforcement team, I had the best crew of guys working for me and gals. You know, you'd be up all night on a surveillance, you know, finding where the gangster lives so the detectives could write the warrant. And then the next morning you'd be writing the warrant, you know, dead ass tired, being up for 2 days and just finally, you know, getting in that place, finding the bad guy, finding the evidence that you need. That was probably one of the best jobs that I had, being the assistant cert team lieutenant and, you know, being on just these amazing calls and watching these, the best operators in the world, just kind of work through this problem that's why you're there, because you have the best. And I think probably the other side was my time as a driving instructor. I really, really enjoyed that.
I was one of those weird detectives that I loved being the guy to write the warrant. Sometimes it took an hour. Sometimes it took three. No, because every time I went into it, you know, a lot of my homicide cases were middle of the night, nobody around. So, I would tell my sergeant, I'll do it. And, you know, I would rush over to the nearest precinct that back then, because I'm so old, it was still fax machines and calling the on-call judge at midnight and sitting in a room alone, raising your right hand to get sworn in. I thought that was the greatest thing, because I knew when I got back and I served that warrant, guess what? Now we're going to start rolling in the right direction. So I am not ashamed to say I loved to write warrants. They were great.
God bless you, brother, because the detectives, because I wrote one warrant in 29 years.
Oh, my God.
Ruling thing. Oh, yeah. But, you know, like I said, the gang enforcement team, I had some of the best detectives in the world that could sit down, knock it out. And that's a good feeling.
Yeah, write that probable cause statement to the judge. There's nothing better, because usually you're calling a 60-year-old in the middle of the night who's pretty pissed off. Like, what in the hell do you want? And you read him the PC statement, and when they're like, oh, yeah, no problem, it feels good.
Yep. You know, and you know, we talked about, you know, coming home to the spouse who, you know, really doesn't know what a rough day at the job was. Well, at the time, my boy's mom was a detective with the police bureau. That's how we met on the job. And, you know, so it, that was nice to be able to come home because she knew what a bad day on the job was. And, you know, that's all you had to say is it wasn't a great day. And there was that empathy there. And that, that did make it nice.
You know, when you talk about your training and you love training, you love instilling, you love keeping your brothers and sisters safe. Looking back now, 30 years almost, what would you tell a young officer today in terms of what you learned? What would be some of the advice, career advice, in terms of being able to go the long haul?
Be patient. Be thick-skinned. Realize that even though they're calling you names and want to hurt you, it's not you as a person. It's because of the uniform that you wear. And that's hard to detach from that. Make good decisions. And I just don't mean tactically, but just, you know, think about others first, stuff like that.
And in terms of, your career, if you had to do it all over again, would you do it differently? You know, a lot of times cops, you know, get, like, for example, when I came in from the military, and Jason did as well.
Yes.
I just assumed my career would go into SWAT because I was with 101st Airborne. I was rappel master, all that hoorah. And also I had just found this love for detective work. And that's what I kind of, you know, end up engulfing, if you will. Is there an assignment that you wish you had taken that you never did? For me, it would have been plainclothes. I never did plainclothes. How about you?
I think the only thing maybe would have been canines. I tried out once. It didn't pass selection, but thought that would have been a blast of an assignment. I mean, you know, you're being called. Every call you go to is a hot call, right? Because they need you and your dog to track down the bag guy. That's probably the only thing. I mean, I had a great career. I have no regrets. I wouldn't have done anything different. You know, even the admin side of being a sergeant and the lieutenant and dealing with personnel issues and you know, reading after actions and writing these long-ass reports, I still enjoyed it because I was taking care of my guys and gals.
And before we get into the commercial break and we come back on the other side and talk about Portland now, talk about Portland then from the 90s. What your take on it? Was that a hometown for you?
No, so I grew up in Southern California. My family and I moved up here when I was 15, I think. So, you know, moving from Southern California, my first couple of years in high school in Portland, I really didn't want to be here, but I soon really, really took a liking to Portland. Beautiful town, clean city. I mean, within an hour and a half, you can be at the coast or you can be up at the mountain skiing. Beautiful, clean city back then.
Yeah, when I visit, and Jason, you correct me if you think it totally different, but I looked at it almost as a small, big city. It had us, you know, everyone's
very
on bicycles.
So. I've been there. Dozens of times, and I love the city.
Yeah, it's
beautiful. You're exactly right. Yeah, it is.
Is that what you saw having gone from like San Diego?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it was a very much had that small town vibe. That, you know, it's the population now is probably twice what it was. You know, in the late '80s, early '90s, when I was first new up here. It had a small town feeling. The suburbs were smaller. And you know, you could get anywhere that you needed to be from one side of the city to the other in 15 minutes. No, that's not the case. It was very much a nice place to finish high school, go to college and start my career.
You know, when I was talking to you about what advice you would give, you mentioned, thick skin. People are going to be calling you names. We're going to take a commercial break now. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about that. People don't maybe not know this, but there was actually some riots going on in Portland, I heard.
There might have been a few, yeah. Might have been on the news a little bit.
One or two.
Yeah.
Hundred.
We'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget
that. Never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
My first call ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Outstanding first segment with Charlie Fender, and we're glad to continue with him through Cop Talk. And Charlie, I don't know if you've listened to us. We're creeping up on 100 episodes, but your great city of Portland has been mentioned
on more than one or two occasions.
And
well, and like Darren knows, I mean, I hadn't listened to your podcast before. I listened to another podcast, and yours just kind of popped up as, you know, you might also like. And I saw, I think it was episode 83, where you talked about the, you know, Portland and Seattle, and a couple stories were told, and I'm like, oh God, it's much worse than that. And we started emailing and talking, and it's significant here.
Yeah, you know, I find it interesting. Like, I try to explain to people, I'm born and raised in Phoenix, Arizona, and I'm almost 50 years old. And this city does not even resemble the town that I grew up in. It is huge. We're the fifth largest city in the country right now. Our crime rate is ridiculous. The way people drive make me want to be a homicide suspect of my own. And again, because of my travels, I've been to Portland many, many times. I have had nothing but wonderful experience. I even did the Cascades train ride from Seattle down to Portland, which was, again, being almost 50 years old, I had never been on an Amtrak. You would have thought it was an eight-year-old on Christmas going through the mountains. It's one of the most incredible 3-hour journeys you can take.
Yeah.
So when I think of Portland from just personal experience, my memories are, you know, it's great food, it's beautiful. As Darren said, it's a big city but has that small town feel. But right now, I wouldn't come to Portland for anything. I mean, I just have no interest. And that's such a bias and such a what I've seen on the news. But your mayor, your city council, I still can't figure out. And you know what? You're the one person I can ask. And if you cannot, Charlie, listen, if you can't answer this question, I respect that. How is Portland the only place that I've heard of where the city commissioner is also the police chief? Because I've never heard...
The mayor's the police chief.
The mayor's the police chief. Yeah. I've never heard of a bigger conflict of interest on top of the fact that he is a fucking douchebag.
Well, and there are worse on the city council than him, and we can talk about that. So, yeah, Portland is one of, I believe...
that's a high bar.
Wow!
That's a high bar.
I just called him a fucking douchebag, and Charlie goes, oh, no!
We have douchier bags.
We have worse.
So, Portland is only one of three cities that I know in which... We have what are... Every city bureau, transportation, fire, police, water, is given to either a council member or the mayor. So the mayor, since I even known, has hit one of his bureaus as a police bureau. Another council member has a fire bureau, and, you know, on down the line between the six of them, I think. So yes, the chief of police's boss is the mayor.
That absolutely makes no sense.
Yep.
That is
because
the dumbest thing I've heard.
Yeah, well, trust me, it gets dumber. Yeah,
well, please share, because I love it. I love hearing, because I don't think much of our city council and mayor currently. So if you can raise the bar for me, I'm good with that.
And I look at stability. When you talk about a police department, you talk about a fire department, you talk about these services, you think you need stability. If the people that are in charge of it and heading it are politicians that are 2 years gone, 3 years, 4 years, whatever, it just seems like not only is it rife with problems because of that, but then you get political aspirations. it seems like a toy. Can you talk a little bit about what you've seen over the years in a police department, a professional organization with such inept leaders?
Oh, God, I wouldn't know where to start. I mean, the big thing is that you've got, you know, cops and detectives and sergeants and the whole police department wanting to go out and do the right thing and doing the right thing on a daily basis, helping people. Yes. And the city council of politicians, heck, even our head district attorney, who I would say a month or two into these, 180 plus day protests, made the decision that of the arrests that the Portland police officers were making and other agencies that were helping, he basically made the decision that he wasn't going to prosecute or file charges on a lot of the protest related crimes, disorderly conduct. You know, if there was a felony person crime involved, like, arson, that kind of stuff, he'd prosecute those. But here you've got the DA making a unilateral decision about what state criminal charges he wasn't going to prosecute, that the police were laying their life on the line for, to make the arrest. How does that make a police department feel?
And making it known. I mean, talk about,
oh God, yes.
He puts it out there. It empowers them. That's got to be so daunting and frustrating. There's a stronger word that police would feel about that. I mean, God, I would. And we've talked about this. There's an exodus going on, isn't there?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, we have a huge retirement coming up next month, that there are about 40 to 50 members that are eligible to retire that absolutely will. On top of that, we've got another 25 that are in backgrounds for other departments in the state. And guys, in my career, I have never seen that. Portland was always the agency that people from outside Portland wanted to come to, because it was the biggest. We had the most calls. We had the most, diversity. We had the most opportunity to promote or go to K-9 or go to the SWAT team. Now people are bailing because they don't want to put up with this shit anymore.
You know, it's amazing you bring that up, Charlie. When I was a brand new officer, so I was the first graduating class of 2000. In my first year, just as a rookie working midnight shifts, four of our officers transferred to Portland. And they, every one of them was telling me, this is the place to be. This is the greatest department, the greatest city. It's going to be where I make my home and work until I retire. And 20 years later, obviously a bunch of my friends are still on the Phoenix Police Department and have risen to the ranks, done their different things. But I'm wondering if those guys who left here to go to Portland are sitting at home at night going, well,
oops,
oops, 20 years ago, big oops. But you're right in what you say. 20 years ago, which may sound like a long time to a lot of people, it's not, it's the blink of an eye. It was the place to go for not only to live, but to be a police officer. And now well, Seattle's probably having a slightly more of a mass exodus than you, and I don't blame them because they actually are a bigger disaster. But I don't blame those Portland cops. And when Portland loses their police officers, you are going to start to see a city get out of control.
We'll talk a little bit about that, because you're seeing that now, aren't you, in terms of calls for service? Do you have enough officers? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think at the highest that I remember our sworn numbers was just a little over 1,000. And this was 15 years ago, I think, and it's been a while since I talked to any of my friends to see what our current numbers are. But I want to say we're under 850, and the department should be about 1,500. I mean, and on top of that, you throw on,
oh my God, 60%.
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus.
Yep. Yeah. And the city's population since then and the metro area has probably doubled.
Easily has doubled.
On top of that, you throw, on all this defunding crap, and, the mayor and the city council, I think within the last 6 months, has defunded and done away with the gang enforcement team, the unit that I used to work. Shootings have tripled since then. Our homicide rate has doubled. Now you've got, the overworked, stressed street cops that are now having to work these scenes. We defunded the SRO program, school resource officer program, did all those away, put those back to the street. And so now you've had, these high schools and middle schools that had a great relationship with their SRO. The SRO knew the schools. They knew who the good kids were, who the bad kids were. That's gone. So now, again, the street cops have to show up, you know, to a school and to an environment that they're not very familiar with and have to solve the problem.
Yeah, no relationship with.
Exactly.
Because SROs are incredibly important.
Yep.
Incredibly absolutely. Important. And we use, I don't know, Darren, you might know, have we gotten rid of that program?
No, we still have SROs.
We still have it. You know, Charlie, and we can put this into perspective again. Portland is what it is. Phoenix is what it is, and the size of it that it is. But we're down a lot of officers compared to I retired in 1996, and we had I think around 3,300 sworn.
And probably, to put that in perspective, Philadelphia, which is smaller, has three times as many.
Exactly, of course. Mm-hmm. And we're currently down to around 2,800 sworn, I think, but not even close to the 60% that Charlie's talking about. However, just the other night, Charlie, Darren, and again, this is from an inside source. I'm not going to drop any names. But in one of our most violent precincts in this large, again, the fifth largest city in the country, at one moment in time, I want you guys to elaborate on this because a lot of civilians won't understand what I'm talking about. In one moment in time, in this one violent precinct, there were 47 calls holding. Now, I don't know if anybody understands this, but suspects and people who commit crimes don't call 911. They don't want police showing up. So these 47 calls that are holding are people who need help. They called for help. And we don't have quite the, I mean, you know, our department's not going in the right direction. I'll admit that. But we have not half the problems that Portland does. If we have 47 calls holding, what is going on in Portland?
So I'll start by saying that our response time to priority calls, so emergencies, priorities 1, 2, and 3, I mean, these are, you know, significant police calls for service, has tripled since this whole thing started. So before we wanted to keep that response time below 5 minutes. So from the time 911 operator gets a call, dispatches an officer arrives, we wanted to keep that under 5 minutes. Now, some of them have been exceeding 15 minutes.
Wow.
You know, these are significant life safety problems, and you never know when the cop's going to show up. Calls are getting dropped from our 911 system because it's so overloaded.
Oh, my God. Yeah, because
seconds feel like minutes when you're in a shooting. And so for and that's from a trained cop in a shooting. So these citizens that are in some type of life-threatening danger call 911, 15 minutes before someone's responding.
That's a lot of time for the perp to get away.
That is a...
Oh, they'll always get away.
Well, it hinders the investigation. It hinders, obviously, the victim and their health.
Their life, yeah.
And life. I can't fathom 15 minutes. I mean, I see a burglary or stolen vehicle call hold for 8 hours, and it makes me want to catch on fire again. To imagine that a shooting or a
rape...
And you know what? A lot of people don't understand, and again, I'm not going to throw the fire department under the bus, but they are very good at their response times. They here in Phoenix, they're like, it's 4 minutes. We will get to you, and they do. However, if they show up on one of our hot calls, a shooting, something like that, they get there first, they won't go in. They will wait.
We're the same way.
They will wait for us, and if it's 15 minutes, that's a lot of time for a victim to be losing blood or dealing with shock or whatever. It's just that's what people don't understand. The people who call 911 want and need help, and we have a responsibility as a city to get there.
It absolutely crosses just about every moral boundary that good people have, and it's tough.
It's got to be so daunting for these cops. And, you know, when I think about something going so bad so quickly, and from our perspective, I'm talking about, you know, just watching the news and watching Fox or CNN or one of these major outlets you're watching. And in 1 second, all of a sudden, it seems like Seattle and Portland both are burning to the ground. Police precincts are being taken over. An entire block in
Seattle.
Yeah,
that shit doesn't happen in Phoenix.
I mean, that's insane. And it seems like it came out of nowhere, but... talking early, this isn't like the ship was turned on a dime. It takes a while for that big ship to turn, you know, in the ocean. You saw something coming many years ago. Tell me about that.
Yeah, the Antifa and the anarchist presence in this town has been here for at least 17 years, because when I was a special event sergeant down at the Central Precinct downtown, again, one of my jobs was to make these peaceful, and you know, again, we can talk all day the difference between a riot and a peaceful First Amendment protest, permitted or not. You know, these groups would come to me, whether it's, you know, it's a union march, it's a May Day march, whatever, decent people to help plan their event. And I would routinely tell them, look, be prepared for the anarchists to hijack your event. Because if 50 anarchists can lead 10,000 people towards their side, or at least get them to a certain location or whatever, it will happen. And so what I would do is I would get the phone number. And I'm working these events. You know, I'm usually on a bicycle riding with my team. I would get the phone number from the organizer, and we'd have, you know, air assets up, and they would tell me, hey, the anarchists are meeting the group at, or trying to divert the group at 3 and Main. So I would call the organizer. I had that good of a relationship with them, and say, hey, make your next left. I know it's not your route, but you do not want these people to hijack your event, because they will make it about them. So that's what they've been doing for, you know, since March, when this whole crap started. So it's been here for a long time.
Charlie, I want to ask you, as an old-time police officer, recently, and correct me on any of these issues, Antifa basically started and is home-based in Portland, Oregon. They were recently...
That I don't know for sure, but it wouldn't surprise me.
They were recently declared by the President of the United States a terrorist organization. Why is that not an immediate response by police and the National Guard to rid the city and the world of Antifa? Because, and I'm not the president, wouldn't want to be, never could be, but they are a terrorist organization. Like looking at the sky and saying it's blue. Antifa is a terrorist organization. How do we not eradicate them? It would take one day. It really would if we put some effort into it. But it doesn't seem like there's even any effort going into that.
I think one of the big reasons that doesn't or hasn't happened is the media. I mean, even the most recent riots that we had, the media, which has all been Antifa anarchist people, trying to burn down precincts with cops locked in.
They love the media. Loves it. The media loved it.
But if you listen to how they portray it, they are still hooking this as a Black Lives Matter event, and no politician.
Another terrorist organization, by the way.
But no politician wants to send, you know, 100 cops out there to a BLM event, which it's not anymore. I mean, let's be honest. When the Floyd thing happened, for about the first 2 weeks after that, we had several peaceful protests. We had thousands of decent Portland people who had a certain opinion about what happened, as every cop in the country did, which was horrific. But they would start at a certain place, they'd march, they'd stick to their route, very peaceful. But then you had Antifa, the anarchists, piggybacking onto these events, and they just continued to roll with them, to where it was every night for like 180 days. They were going to battle with the cops. But I think it was the media that was still trying to make this about Floyd and BLM. And it stopped being about that the marches about 2 weeks into it.
And you were saying that this Antifa group has been around for, oh my God, you know, a decade.
Well, I think they're learning
their trade.
Yeah.
So if they were able to hijack legitimate, good protests, and again, you know, our nation was founded on a protest from the England. So, I mean, we're absolutely 100% for protests in terms of reform and all those good things protecting people's rights. That's what you did for a job. It amazes me that this organization learned what they've learned 17 years ago, and so they were so good at what they did. Sadly, they're successful, and the media has just bought into it. Talk about a little bit about that.
Well, I know for a fact, talking about the national organization of these groups, I know for a fact that at a more national level, several of the anarchists and the Antifa people that were in Portland protesting didn't live in Portland, but they were being put up at local hotels. I guarantee you they're not paying for that. And so as far as I'm concerned, when it comes to making arrests for these people, they should go at them at the federal RICO standard. I mean, it's an organized crime.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I don't know how many times Jason and I have talked about you see something occur and they beat, you know, the ambulance to the scenes. They are organized and they're doing criminal activity. That's organized crime, like you said.
Yep. We went against gangsters on RICO charges back in the 90s and won and successfully put away hardcore violent gangsters. Why not do that for these guys?
I have to ask, in the closing minutes that we have left, how do you feel about the police officers today? I mean, because we all felt, you know, had that pride in doing what we did. And I've said so many times, I don't know if I could do it today. I don't know if I would stay in the job and take this level of abuse because no one has your back. I mean, you know, your brothers and sisters do, but when your ultimate boss is a politician who talks trash, I mean, I can't even imagine that level of pain. I really can't.
Well, my heart goes out to him. I mean, to be subject to nightly violence like that, you know, and Darren, you and I talked about this earlier, there is going to be years worth of PTSD involved in this. You know, they were on the line every night for more than 180 nights, having Molotov cocktails thrown at them, their precincts burned down, and yet they're holding a line. And, you know, I'd get up in the morning before I went to work, have my coffee, watch the news. And, it, you know, for the longest time, it was the opening segment on the morning news. I just had to stop because I couldn't watch anymore. You know, part of me honestly wishes I was still on the job leading these folks, you know, leading either a squad or whatever. But another part of me is like, you know, I did 29 and a half years of that stuff. It's good to be a retired Portland cop. I still have a lot of friends in the police bureau and talk to them. And hey, how's everybody doing? And, you know, we're tired. We're, you know, unsupported. Morale is low. And it's like, you know, part of me wants to be there trying to help a little bit.
That's incredible. Thank you enough.
I got chills.
Yeah, it really is. It's heartbreaking. I love to hear that your voice cracked a little bit. You got a little bit emotional because there are a lot of us that truly care about this and care about what's going on. And I do pray for Portland. I do. I mean, it's easy for us. And Darren, we do it. We talk about Portland. We talk about Seattle. And it might sound in some ways like we're making fun of them.
It's heartbreaking.
And they richly deserve that on the politician side. But yeah, those frontline workers that are taking rocks and bottles and lasers to the eye and their precincts are getting burned down.
The injury.
These are human beings that still go home to their own spouse and children. And it's just the division is unreal. So thank you for sharing the way you did.
It's our family. You know, it's funny. I've got 17-year-old twin boys and one of them wants to be a police officer. And he's like, yeah, but not in Portland, Dad, not in Seattle. I mean, you know, and of course, you know, his mom and I are both retired Portland cops. So, you know, he's heard a little bit about the job in the city. And I commend him for wanting to do a great, you know, an amazing profession. But he knows enough to go, you know, not here in Portland. He's kind of more the right-sided thinking as well, as far as his political views. So he's like, yeah. How about Montana, Wyoming, North Idaho? I
said Texas. Go to Texas. Yeah. Be a cop in Dallas or Houston.
You're appreciated. Yeah. We've got, you know, support of the people and the city council and that kind of stuff.
And I want to, closing statement here, when you talked about the media, and I think it's so spot on. Recently, I have friends that are on the other side of the aisle. They're liberal, but they're good people. They just, you know, have different views, which is fine because there's always that middle ground that we can talk about. But recently one of them was talking to me and said, well, there really wasn't anything going on in Portland. And I was aghast. I said, what news agency do you watch? And sure enough, it was CNN. And the three of us had to kind of convince this young lady that no, there's officers being hurt and blinded and maimed for the rest of their lives. And you're not hearing this on the news.
Wait till they listen to this show.
Oh, heartbreaking. Well, again, we can't thank you enough for being on our show and sharing your pain and the love of all things Portland, the tale of two cities before and after the funding of the police.
Thank you very much for having me here and let me vent a little bit.
Oh, absolutely.
Please do.
We'll be right back for our last segment, Heroic Headlines, Super Suspects, and Jason's inspirational message. We'll be right back.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Batch Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Batch Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Batch Boys.
You know, Jason, we could talk to any fellow cop, career cop, and you instantly love them. And that's me, Charlie just called out of blue or emailed out of blue about the episode 83 that he heard and said, wait a minute, it's a lot worse, guys. It's a lot worse. And yeah. Boom, talking, and now he's just a buddy. It's that passion of helping the community. And right now, all our hearts are breaking for what we see in law enforcement.
For sure. And, you know, what I love about Charlie is not only did he just tell the truth, but you could hear in his voice. He was very emotional about it.
Vulnerable. He humanized police
and
officers.
He, yes, he did. Yes. He did the job the right way, no doubt. And the company he works for now is going to greatly benefit from not only his expertise and training, but the simple fact that he's got a heart and compassion and he cares. And as always, great job, Darren.
Again, when I think of police and I think of Charlie and all the cops, they're all heroes to me. They're all heroes. They really are. But especially now, my gosh. And who better to talk about heroes and heroic events, small and large, our Jason.
Well, this week we are going to be talking about a father and son who thwarted an armed suspect who attempted to steal from their vehicle, and they restrained him until police arrived. You know, Darren, I must be out of law enforcement for way too long, because it's getting to the point, people who steal from you, and it's what I guess our legislators would call smaller crimes, I think the punishment needs to go up and up and up. And I give these guys credit for not killing this guy, because I think that I would have. But it was in Spartanburg, South Carolina. An armed thief in Spartanburg probably thought that he was breaking into a vehicle that would be oh so easy. However, that plan quickly changed when a father and son saw the break-in happening and were able to disarm the suspect and detain him until the police arrived. The incident was reported on December 17th after the father and son witnessed the suspect, identified as Anton Sidorchuk, allegedly rummaging through his truck. Instead of scaring him off or waiting for police to arrive or doing what I would have done, kill him, the father and son decided to take action themselves, and the dynamic duo approached the suspect. He initially fled from the truck. The two I love this, got in a foot pursuit with him into a neighboring property, and when Sidorchuk felt that he was trapped, he pulled a knife and threatened the father and son. Again,
wow.
Deadly force is now justified.
Absolutely.
It wasn't just me going crazy. It's now justified. But instead, the father and son moved in. They were able to take control of the knife of the suspect, putting the suspect's arm behind his back. They took him down to the ground, and they held him in place until deputies from the Spartanburg Police Department arrived. And two guys like that, I give them a lot of credit. They stuck up for themselves. They stuck up for future unknown victims, and they did not allow their emotions to get out of control. and lets Vardenberg do their job. This guy is now in jail for the attempted burglary. And I just deeply appreciate people who there is right and wrong. There yeah. is good and evil in this world. And it should be that simple. And so to this father and son, way to go. You made the world a better place and you protected other people that you're never even going to know you did that for. So thank you.
Messed with the wrong dudes.
You definitely messed with the wrong dudes. I love that. You know what's great? In South Carolina, that father and son probably went home, cracked open a couple of beers, and were like, what's on TV?
Hell yeah.
Let's go. All right, Darren. That was a little bit of heroism, so go ahead and ruin my day.
Well, yeah, you talked about these, father and son team, almost like picturing a lion in the bear cup, showing the way. So I'm going to take you to two stories of people acting like other type of animals. A naked man with a giant panda head seen roller skating on Ohio Highway. Yep, that's right.
Yep. Dude.
Dude, true.
Dude.
I know. Columbus, Ohio, a white male was caught on camera rollerblading naked down on an 8-lane Ohio highway while wearing only a giant plush panda head and his skates. The roller streaker, if you will, was seen zipping and remarkably at a high speed while clutching a golf club. I think he was using a golf club as kind of like a oar, I guess. This was on December 16th. This was angering and bewildering drivers, as you can only imagine. When the drivers would honk, this birthday-suited skater, streaker, would move to the shoulder of the highway. So at least he was, obeying traffic laws, I guess. The strange individual identity hasn't been identified at all. They have no idea who he is.
Wait, where was this again?
This was Columbus, Ohio, on an 8-lane highway. Well,
that's the part I'm more jealous about. They have an 8-lane highway?
Yeah, I know. who knew?
Phoenix, get your shit together. These 4-lane highways aren't doing it. I want an 8-lane highway.
Yeah, because I want to get my panda head out. A spokesman for the Ohio Department.
I just want to get somewhere faster, Robin. I'm not with Darren on this.
You can borrow my panda head.
No, I just want to get somewhere faster.
A spokesman for the Ohio Department of Transportation, look at this situation very serious, because they're serious in Ohio. Quote, pedestrians are not permitted on interstate highways. Well, or maybe not wearing that, birthday suit as well, huh? The police are still looking for him, but there's really no identifiable features. Now, I will say this. It was cold, and he was full turtle.
Probably why he wore the panda head, because he was so embarrassed.
And he was full turtle. What?
It was cold, so that Robin, may be identifiable.
What is wrong with my co-host?
I was going to go there, but he actually saved me.
Between you and I, what is wrong with our co-host?
Not a damn thing.
Thank you.
Full turtle.
He went full turtle.
This is like a Seinfeld episode from 1996.
Turtle. and I'm going to call this guy the Panda Express Bandit, I guess. Because maybe he's promoting Panda Express. I don't know.
And I was going to have that for lunch today after we left.
And now
here,
you know what you'll be thinking. I'll have the turtle plate, please.
He's now not going to be able to look
at
the noodles.
No, I'm just going to go to In-N-Out Burger and
rice.
Not even think about
Darren. Chow mein.
No, not even think about Darren.
Now, if there's a state that could outdo Ohio,
Florida? What?
Thank you. There's a Florida story.
One.
Yeah.
Sorry,
Florida never fails to disappoint. The headline here is meth-fueled, mud-covered, naked Florida man acting like birds and dogs, shakes off two tasers, bites a canine, and has fist fights with the officers. Yeah.
Damn.
Yeah, fight a canine. I love my canine.
A canine. The dispatcher said they received a 911 call about a nude person being in some guy's yard with a flashlight. Deputies could see the flashlight when they responded. They eventually found 38-year-old Donald Watts, who was in a shallow creek or ditch with water. Again, he's completely naked, covered with mud. He was pacing back and forth, laughing, and making what they said sounded like bird noises. I have no idea what that would sound like, but it sounded like bird noises. At first, he ran into a mobile home. Had to be a mobile home. It's Florida. And then he came out of the door swinging. He went from being a nice bird to a pissed off parakeet, I guess. He proceeded to run into some nearby woods before continuing to pursue Watts. The two deputies waited for backup. Good for them. More assistance arrived in the way of a canine dog, Casper. They found Watts in the woods. He got on his hands and knees and then began to growl like a dog, I guess maybe talking to Casper. Casper was given the command to apprehend Watts, who leaped up, grabbed Casper, the dog, by the head, and bit Casper's ear as he drove Casper into the ground. Now, Casper got the last laugh because Casper went ahead and bit him and took some chunks out of him. But yes. The guy was fighting cops, fighting Casper, fighting everybody. This is a bad guy that needs to go to jail, and he did. We just need to bring the Panda Express Bandit to jail, too. And that is your stupid suspect stories.
Jason's like speechless over there.
I don't know why I come in here.
You need to inspire us. Lift us up from that.
You know, I just want, we can find inspiration every day if it's right there in front of us. And as we close out this year, as we are a couple days away from Christmas, I just want to say thank you to our grocery store workers, our over-the-road truck drivers, our police officers, our firefighters, our nurses, our frontline workers. I hope that you all get the vaccine first. I thank you for what you have basically been doing since March 1st that got the rest of us, that the three of us in this room would not be where we are today if it wasn't for these simple everyday
truth
heroes, and they inspire me every time I go into the grocery store. I was just in there yesterday, and while the clerk was loading my bag, I could not even find the words to say, you know what, thank you for coming to work every day and doing what you're doing, loading my groceries. It's those simple little things, and that's what I find inspiration in. And then I went home and I thought about them, and I will continue to do that. It's not the actors, it's not the pro athletes, although I love watching sports every weekend. I'm glad it's back on, but they're not the ones that matter. It's these everyday people that are what we call the necessity, and they've suffered the most. And a simple thank you doesn't quite do it, but you really have inspired me throughout 2020. It's probably going to continue through the first 4 to 6 months of 2021. Hopefully next year's Christmas show, we'll just simply sit back and say, things are back to normal. That is my hope. That is my dream. But I thank you all for being necessary to the rest of us, inspiring people like me every single day, and keep doing what you're doing. God bless all of you. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. And we will see you all next week.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.